Welcome to Dear Wallflower, your podcast advice column for the woman who desires to deepen and beautify her inner world. With every episode, I, along with frequent guests and experts, will answer a letter from listeners just like you who are looking for insight and wisdom on the most pressing questions in their story right now. Make sure to stick around until the end for recommendations on books, movies, music, lifestyle, beauty, and more. I'm so glad you're here. Grab a cup of tea and come on in. Welcome, dear listeners, to this episode of Dear Wallflower, a podcast for the woman with a deep inner world. I am your host, Kelia Clarkson. I am an actress, writer, and the editor-in-chief of Wallflower Journal. And this week, I am very excited to introduce you to our wonderful guest. Caitlin Schess is a writer, the author of The Liturgy of Politics and The Ballot in the Bible, a doctoral student at Duke Divinity School, and a theologian. She has written for various outlets, such as The New York Times, Christianity Today, Relevant, and many more. And I am so glad to have her with us to speak into today's letter. Caitlin, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We will be getting to this week's letter in just a few moments, but first, let's get into our pre-letter segment of the show called Roses and Thorns, where we will recount our highs and lows of the week, starting with a thorn, something that left us feeling dry or depleted or frustrated, and finishing off with our rose, something that fostered our inner world, brought us joy, or built us up that week. And as we recount our roses and thorns, I would love to encourage you, listeners, to be thinking through your own roses and thorns, to reflect on the various joys and difficulties that this past week has brought you, and to face another week with a posture that is ready to handle disappointments and a heart that is ready to soak up joy. So, Caitlin, beginning with your thorn, what was your thorn this week, and what was your rose?
Yeah, so I think my thorn this week was probably, this sounds kind of boring, but I have not gotten good sleep for like 3 or 4 nights in a row. And it's just amazing how much that affects your whole life and day. And it's not even for a good reason. It's my own fault. It's like, I think I'll go to bed at a certain time and then I find other tasks to do. And suddenly it's way later than I thought and I have to get up early. And it's been interesting. Even in just the last few years, I feel like I've finally gotten old enough where I'm like, oh, I don't function without a certain amount of sleep. I feel like when I was younger, I could just go regardless. And that sense of willpower eventually gives up. And you're just like, I'm not as functioning with, you know, lack of sleep. So that has like effects in a bunch of ways. Like I'm kind of grumpier and not as productive. And so even though it's my own fault, it's really like, okay, we keep having various reasons why I'm not getting enough sleep. So that's probably my thorn. And my rose, this is a great week to have to talk about this because Easter was this last Sunday. And I just spent the whole day with different groups of people from my church. Mm-hmm. And I have had in my fairly recent past a pretty traumatic church experience. And I'm in a really healthy, really flourishing church now. And it's been a really healing experience for the last 3 years, but especially this last Sunday, it was just, for a variety of reasons, was a reminder of really restoration and redemption and this sense of, wow, it's amazing how much sweeter this is, knowing some of the things I have suffered. Not that it means I'm glad I went through it. Not that it means it was, you know, something that I want everyone to go through, but it was a special day to just feel really cared for by my community. I spent time with truly like wide range of ages and experiences. I love serving in the nursery at my church because I love little kids. So I started out the day with little kids in their Easter outfits and being really excited and playing games. And then I hung out in between the services with the youth group for a little while. So I got to hang out with some teenagers, you know, had a brunch where I talked to a bunch of people my age who are, you know, there's a ton of my churches across the street from Duke's campus. So tons of grad students, tons of faculty. So hung out with a bunch of people kind of in my age and stage of life, got hugs from some like elderly members of my community that, you know, one of them saw me running outside her house recently and just kind of said, I'm so glad that you're taking time for yourself. You know, it's just like this sweet day of community. And after a lot of pain, that was just especially sweet this week.
Wow. That is so incredible. And I'm so glad that you found a place that is just so redemptive to your journey and your faith. So that's just such a lovely rose. My thorn this week has been that it's just been so strangely rainy in Los Angeles, which is just not it's just not what you expect, especially on the weekends, which is sad because those are the days, of course, as many people do, that I just decide to take some time for myself and go out. And so it's just been a disappointment every week for a little while. And having grown up here, it's also just so strange. I've never seen the weather act this way. And I do love the rain, but it's just not what I'm expecting. So that's just been a little bit thorny. But my rose is actually kind of similar to yours, Caitlin. I have been reflecting this week on the blessings that I have received over the past year, especially, you know, with Easter that that kind of brought on some of this reflection. And one thing that came to mind is the church that my husband and I have been going to. And we have struggled over the years to find one that we felt like we really fit into, that we really enjoyed going to, and that we just felt welcomed at. Not that we've been to churches where people were rude, but just that we didn't feel like we clicked. And so we finally found a church and a little community just about, weirdly, 5 minutes from our apartment. That is just so warm and welcoming and encouraging and inspiring to my faith. And it's just so lovely to see the same faces there every single week. And, you know, there's this one lady who, she's just the sweetest woman in the world. And she always sees that I'm really cold because for some reason it's just always cold in the church. And so she's bringing blankets for me.
So
it's just that as Easter, this was our first Easter celebration, at that church. And so as we celebrated that, I really started reflecting on the last year there and how thankful I've been to have that particular rose kind of blooming for a while. So
I love that.
Yeah. All right. So just a couple of things before we move on to the letter for this week. If you have been enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving us a review. It helps so much to boost it and get the podcast in front of other people who might enjoy it and get something from it and maybe even identify with one of the letters that we read. And make sure to share it with a friend. And lastly, I would love to encourage you to send in your own letter to dearwallflower@wallflowerjournal.com. My guests and I would be just so honored to have the opportunity to speak into the issues that you are facing in your story today. Okay, so let's move on to our letter for today, which covers the subject of women in theology. Dear Wallflower, I am a reader and lover of deep thoughts. For as long as I can remember, I have had my nose in a book, reading on various subjects and going down different rabbit holes. Recently, my reading has shifted to focus more on theology, and I've been surprised by how much I've enjoyed it. I didn't grow up in a family that explored theological concepts very much, so there's a lot that is new to me. As a result, sometimes I feel lost and perhaps not smart enough to understand some of the concepts that are presented. There's a part of me that wants to pursue a theological education further, but my lack of familiarity with it, coupled with the fact that it can often feel like somewhat of a boys' club, has given me pause at the thought of pursuing theology more seriously. As I am in my early 20s now, am I too late to this? And is there a place for me in a world that seems to be dominated by men and people who are years ahead of me in their education from thinking theologically? So, Caitlin, I know that you are going to have so much insight into this question. So I would love to know, what are some initial thoughts that you have for your writer? And if you can also begin to share a little bit about your personal journey and how you became interested in studying theology, I would also love to know about that.
Yeah, thank you. I am so delighted by this letter. It's such a beautiful description of something I really resonate with. And also it's a good reminder to me that, you know, the last goodness, what am I now on my 6th, 7th, 8th year of theological education? And it's easy 8 years in to think, oh, this is just natural. You know, of course, I've loved theology since I was a little kid. This has been so, you know, genuinely enjoyable and edifying. And I've had a lot of support and encouragement. But it's good to remember, I mean, my senior year of college, when I was making a decision to go to seminary, I was terrified. I mean, I forget sometimes how scared I was. And it was a combination of growing up in churches where there were not significant leadership or teaching roles for women. So it felt kind of silly to go study theology. But even more than that, I think it was just, I had this idea that it was kind of irresponsible. Like, you should have a career plan for anything you're studying. And I didn't have a career plan. I mean, I would later come to a position that was very accepting and encouraging of women's participation in leading and teaching in the church. But even if I had thought differently, I just think at the time I didn't have a career goal. So I thought, this is irresponsible. This is a little silly. And I didn't know anyone, a man or a woman, who had gone to seminary. I definitely didn't know any women. And so it did feel terrifying. I remember being scared to tell my parents. I remember being scared to tell my friends. And now it feels really natural, but it was really frightening. And when I finally made the decision, I actually have a picture on my wall behind my computer of the place in my college where I finally had this moment. I was praying, trying to figure out what to do. And I just suddenly had the thought, you know, if I just knew I would be okay, I would do it. Like, if I knew things would work out, I would do it. And the Lord in his kindness basically said to me, like, are you worried you won't be okay? Like, you're going to be okay. Like, are you doubting that you'll be okay? And in that moment, I just like made this decision of, okay, I don't have a career plan. I don't have some idea of where this will lead. I don't even know where I'll go to school. I don't know what conclusions to my theological questions I'll come to, but I'm just going to go do it. And it was probably a month later, I found that exact spot in the hallway and took a picture of the floor. I was just like, this was the place where I made this decision. And it was the second I got to seminary, was happy I was there. I mean, I sat in my car and cried after my first class because I just thought, I can't believe I get to do this. This is the most amazing, wonderful thing. And also spent a lot of time feeling very imposter syndrome-y, like someone's going to find out that I don't know anything and they know all these things. And I remember telling a friend, like, I'm going to accidentally do a heresy. Like, I'm going to say something in class that I just think is a normal comment, and everyone will quiet and be like, oh my goodness, she just said this heretical thing. So I was very scared. And pretty quickly at the same time, as I'm like terrified, starting to like write my first papers and speak up a little bit in class because I had questions that people weren't asking, almost immediately thought, I don't think I'm going to be done with this in a few years when I finish my master's degree. Like, I think I'm just going to keep going. So that's a little of my story. I would say my other kind of initial response to this question is, first of all, it's definitely not too late. I mean, I think the person in the letter said, or, you know, early 20s, I was in my early 20s when I started seminary, and I had no real theological education before that. And that was my fear, that my peers had gone to Bible college or they had majored in theology and I was coming in without any of that. And honestly, a lot of them were worse off because a lot of them came in with, I already know a lot and I know what questions to ask and I know what the answers are. I came in and I was like, I've never thought about any of these things. So I'm asking questions very genuinely, which is a great motivation to read and write and keep trying things and coming back even when you run up against a wall, because I was genuine in my questioning. And I didn't come with so many preconceived ideas of, oh, well, if you wander down that path, then you'll go into this camp and that's bad. And then you kind of, you know, you come out of the church that you were a part of. I was just curious. I was just open. Like, let's see where my questions lead me. Let's see where the theology I'm reading leads me. Let's see where scripture leads me. I think that was a real gift to me. But also in a lot of my theological education, a lot of my peers, especially women peers, have been much older than me. I was in a small group, a spiritual formation group when I was in seminary, where I was the youngest person by like 20 years, because so many of the women were second career or they'd had kids first. And then when their kids got older, they went to school. So there's both just so many men and women who are a variety of ages pursuing theological education, but also it's such a gift. Like, it's a gift for them to have some experience in life and then come and ask these questions and read these books. It's a gift to the younger students that there are a variety of ages and experiences. So that's one thing I'll say. And then the other thing I'll say is just, I had a professor in seminary when I was considering doing a PhD and thought, you know, there's no jobs. There's no jobs in the humanities. Like, no, I want to go do a PhD in the humanities. And I was trying to figure out, like, should I even do this? And he said, you know, the contemplation of God is an inherent good. It doesn't need to be tied to any job or career. And there are still practical questions to be asked about how much debt you go into and what you're paying and where you live. And that's, so it's not to say that there aren't good practical questions to ask. There are. But I have hung on to that for myself and for the many women I talk to who are in the position of this writer, and just saying, if it is possible for you to do it without forsaking obligations you have, without going into irresponsible debt, you know, there's those practical questions aside, the contemplation of God is an inherent good, and doing it in community with people who've been doing it for a long time is a fabulous way to do it. You can do it in other ways as well, but there is a real good gift to having trusted scholars who've studied for a long time tell you what stuff is worth reading and what isn't, and helping you know, these are really good questions. And maybe if you ask this one, try a little harder, you know, think a little deeper. What else could you ask beyond that? Having a community of people who are really different from you, who ask different questions, who have different experiences, like being in classes, especially at my seminary, very international, being in classes where people who grew up in different parts of the world asked questions about what scripture said, about how our churches functioned. I mean, I will never forget someone in one of my seminary classes talking about the parable of the prodigal son, and us having a whole conversation about, you know, for people who aren't familiar, in one of the parables that Jesus tells of this man who has two sons, and one of his sons asks for his inheritance before his father has died, and then goes off and wastes it, and then comes back penniless and having been eating the food the pigs were eating, and his father embraces him. And this is this picture of God embracing wayward children. But a lot of us were just like, wow, this terrible, flagrant, like irresponsible person. And someone in class saying, pointing out to us that the text gives us some indications that maybe part of what happened actually was that there was a famine and the weather was not good. And he had great plans for this thing he was going to do, and they fell through because of things that were outside of his control. And it added a whole other layer to this story. It didn't just make the story about someone who does bad things and comes back to God. Now it's a story of someone who has done some bad things, but has also been just the product of things outside of their control. They've been harmed by a broken world. They're beat down by it, and they come and their father embraces them. Mm-hmm. And this was coming from someone who knew what it was like to be subject to the whims of the weather when it came to food production, unlike those of us in a Western country who go to the grocery store and take bread off the counter and don't really think much about it. And so that's a real benefit to you learning theology in a community with people who kind of know how to guide you and lead you. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be oriented towards a job for it to be valuable. I think more women who are called should go get theological education to serve in roles in the church. Absolutely. But in my experience, it tends to be people who think of seminary or other forms of theological education as just a given, who do it without a vocational plan. They think, oh, sure, I'll go study some things. And it's not as often women who think, we're very practical sometimes. And we've often been taught you do something for a certain goal or it's irresponsible. And I wish we told more women, not just you can preach, you can lead in the church, which I believe to be true, but also you have a mind that can be nourished by deep theology, and you don't have to have a vocational plan to go study it. It's just a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. If you're able to do it, you should do it.
Yeah. So I loved everything that you just said. And this leads me to kind of another question. What have you loved most about having so much dedicated time to studying theology? And what do you think are some of the soul and mind rewards that we might reap from a life in this?
Yes. Oh, that's a wonderful question. I think having been exposed to so many different theological positions. So most of the classes you'll take, you know, they'll say there's 42 different answers to this question, and here's some, you know, pros and cons of each of them. And some people can go into that with an attitude of, okay, I need to weigh all the evidence and pick the right position. But when over and over and over again, you're exposed to the diversity of opinions on certain questions, I think it over time teaches you to be curious and to hold some things more loosely. I feel like I finished seminary, and when I was starting my doctorate, I felt more strongly about the kind of essentials of the Christian faith. When we say the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed in my church, those words feel rooted to me because I've spent time studying where they come from and who fought over them and how we ended up with this kind of particular language because of all these fights in the background. But then other questions outside of those concrete, like really important foundational questions, I have opinions about them, but it has helped me hold them more loosely because I have been in class with people who disagree deeply about them, who were faithful people, smart people, kind people, and it's helped me be curious instead of defensive about some of my positions. It's kind of like, I think it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where like the little that you know makes you more confident, and the more that you know, you're like, I don't know anything. I have found that to be not, you know, not universally true, but very often true, that early in seminary, especially a lot of my male peers, confident to the death about very specific theological questions. And then by the time we were graduating, many of the people I had rolled my eyes at the beginning, like, goodness, you are pompous and full of yourself and sectarian. And by the end, many of them had been humbled because they came face to face with people who disagreed with them and weren't idiots, people who had thought deeply about this and come to different conclusions. And that experience, I think, is really good to foster curiosity and foster humility. And then the other thing I'll say is like a good mind soul kind of thing is we live in a world, and this is changing, but I still think many of us live in a world where we are habituated to think this material world is all there is. If you bring in anything else, that's kind of weird woo-woo stuff that no one really takes seriously. And again, I do think that's changing. I think increasingly we're living in a world where people think lots of weird stuff can happen and who knows. But we are still often, I think, tempted to have purely material explanations for everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that does something grating to the human soul that was not made to live or believe that way. And so spending all of your time, or at least lots of your time, with your nose in theology books and talking through it with people who are reading the same things, I do think it just kind of opens up the world to all these other big mysterious questions. Like if you're spending hours talking to someone about the nature of the Trinity, how is this possible that we worship one God, but there's three persons, mm-hmm. and you read a lot of stuff about it and you tinker with different metaphors and none of the metaphors are right. I end up in this place of just like, the world is weirder than I thought, and there's more going on behind the curtain than I realized. And I just think humans were meant to live in that kind of world. And so the more that we read and talk to each other and learn to live in that kind of world, I think just because of how we were made, we function better. I enjoy living in a world where, yes, there are material explanations for lots of things, but also I'm not totally surprised by some of the weird stuff. Like I believe there is more than just this. And even if you don't end up teaching in a church or becoming a theology professor or any of the kind of careers we could associate with learning theology, I think that's a real benefit for a full life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think allowing ourselves to kind of admit, maybe there are things that either I can't understand right now, or I won't ever fully understand me. I think that really allows us to kind of acknowledge the complexity and the intricacies of God and the way that he has created this world, that in ways that we are not going to be able to understand everything. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, that we can't totally capture everything. But so what I would love to know is, because our writer is a young woman, what do you think women specifically, what do we stand to gain from educating ourselves theologically, whether we choose to do it in an academic setting mm-hmm. or we choose to do it independently?
Yeah. I mean, I think many things. One thing comes to mind, even going back to the earlier part of our conversation, is whether you're in seminary or some other theological education or you're not, you should be learning in some kind of community, which I forgot to say earlier is an important part of this too, is maybe it's not formal theological education that you need, but you don't have to do it alone. You can do it with peers. You can do it in your church. You can find ways to, and everyone should find ways to be learning and studying in community. And so then that's first of all, one real gift is it's been true historically that the church is essentially run by women, even though historically women have been kept out of many leadership positions in the church. Who is like actually keeping the mechanics of the whole thing running? It's usually women. If the men plan a potluck, there will just not be some like basic logistics carried out, right? I think there's some old joke about like, there would be no plates or napkins. They would have brought food, but like none of the infrastructure for the thing would. And I think that's true outside of potlucks. It's just like women are generally speaking the kind of under the surface system that is keeping a church going. And if that's true, and we are depriving most of those women from real theological education, our churches are not good places. They're not going to be very healthy. They're not going to be flourishing. And one of my seminary professors likes to say, you know, the church should not be a single parent household. We should have men and women leading together, and they need to be theologically educated to lead well together. There are even some New Testament scholars who think that some of the passages that we have gone to in the past to say that women can't lead in the church, some of them may have been even really talking about the fact that women in the first century who were pretty wealthy and had homes that could host churches were getting undue leadership positions without the necessary education because it was often denied to them. And so even at the very beginning of the church, there was this sense of, well, we don't want the leaders of the church to not be well theologically trained and educated, not to be elitist, but because it matters what we believe and how we live together. And whether it's men or women, we don't want the people leading to not have that education. So that would be one thing. Is just, this is a gift for yourself. Like we've already talked about, here's how it nourishes your soul and your brain and your mind. But here's also how it's a gift to your community. We want to have Christian communities where tons of people, and especially both genders, have access to theological education, to thinking deeply about God.
Yeah.
I think another reason that it's especially good for women, and this is kind of, I guess, the same reason, but more specifically, is as I mentioned already, there are things that we miss when we're not in diverse communities. And that's true for women then too, of if our churches, if our seminaries, if our communities are only hearing from men, there's huge things that are lost. This is kind of a humorous example and a little like off color, I apologize, but there's a story in scripture of Rahab, who's described as a prostitute, and how the men of Israel were trying to scout out this city that they were going to attack. And they went to Rahab and she hid them in the city. And then because she was able to recognize that she has a line where she's the only one really in the story who knows, your God is powerful. And so I am afraid of what will happen if I don't help you. And she saves Israel. She's described in scripture as this hero, this woman, Rahab. Well, for a long time, people sort of still looked down on Rahab because they thought she's a prostitute. That's not a good thing. So she's sort of like an ambiguous character. Sure, she helps Israel, but also here's some points against her. Well, it was not until pretty far into the history of biblical scholarship that women especially noticed, hey, when these scouts from Israel go into the city, why is the first place that they went the house of a prostitute? And they noticed that there's lots of literary features in this text that are actually really trying to pass judgment on those scouts and say, your priorities were wrong. You were supposed to see if the city was okay for us to attack. And the first place you went was a place that would have been well publicized. People would have known where the prostitute's house was. But it was women scholars who said, because we don't have this implicit bias about women, we're seeing features of this story that weren't seen before. We're seeing not just kind of a different take on the story or asking different questions, but then it opened up, there's actually all of this, these literary features. There's words in the text that had not been understood well before because of an assumption about what the story meant. So it was a very long way of saying, we need women. We need women's perspectives. We need women who are trained to do well thought out work. And that's true in this very technical example with these women who knew Hebrew and were really into the details of this text of this story. It's also true of women who are in a Bible study at their church and everyone's kind of going one direction, asking one kind of question, thinking one way about this story. And it's a woman who's been reading some theologian in her spare time or has been taking a one-off class at a seminary online or has enrolled as a full-time student and just has a different perspective and asks a different question. And suddenly that new question, that new insight, because of the studying that she's been doing and because of her unique perspective, becomes a gift to this community that would have been lost otherwise.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think obviously God created both men and women, right? So women have a very particular and unique perspective that is really valuable. And it's one that can't be replicated, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's value when it comes to women's perspectives in viewing God, and women in theology provide an even fuller picture of God. Yes. If that's what we want to understand is God, well, we're going to have a better picture of him when we take both men and women's perspectives into account. So what I love about this conversation is that you and I have such different backgrounds. You have been in this world for quite a while, and you have so much education in this world. And that is not my story. But interestingly, I feel like what I love is that we are both still passionate about studying and knowing God. Mm-hmm. And speaking from personal experience, I can really identify with our writer today. I did not grow up a believer, really. But for the listeners who are familiar with my family, the Clarksons, I married into a family of people who were and are deeply interested in faith and theology, so much that they have many degrees in theology. And even the ones who don't hold degrees have been studying it for decades. And so as someone who's experienced this feeling of, wow, everyone around me knows so much more than I do about this incredibly intricate and complicated subject, and I feel so out of place. I'm having a difficult time keeping up with these conversations. I feel insecure. I don't know what that word meant. All these feelings are so valid. And that being said, I have seen more than just once my sisters-in-law and my mother-in-law give the boys a run for their money when speaking about theological concepts. So that's been very fun. But over the years, it's been really helpful more and more to not compare myself. And I know that's such a difficult thing to do, but to not compare where I was in my journey with the people that I was surrounded with. And you know, through my in-laws, I met so many of their friends who were also deeply intelligent in this area and so, so wise. And so it was like I really had to challenge myself to not compare where I was and just simply pursue the knowledge that I found that I had a hunger for, and to, you know, press expand on the tabs of questions that drew me in and the path that I found that I also really enjoyed, like our writer today. And there was actually, weirdly, something so valuable about being thrown into the deep end. I, you know, instead of checking out of conversations that I didn't understand and saying, I don't know what any of this is about, I decided to stay and listen, and I ended up soaking up so much more than I even realized. Even when I thought I wasn't understanding anything, it started working its way in. And another thing that really helped me here was just allowing myself to be the person who, okay, I don't know what this is. And just allowing myself to ask questions, to ask what this word means. Why do we say that? Well, why is that not what the, you know, people have come to conclude about this? To ask for book recommendations, podcast recommendations. And through these acts, I found that I was not only constantly learning so much more than I realized, but I also began to form my own opinions and gain confidence in why I thought the things that I did. There are just so few things as important as the study of God, and so few things as life-changing as the study of God. It's the study of the person that created you and me and everything else that we can see. And so I think pursuing this kind of knowledge is something that every single Christian should be encouraged to do. It is not something that should be, you know, sequestered inside the universities or to only one gender. It's something that we should all have access to, because it's just the basis of everything else. So it's been so incredible to see kind of how our different journeys have still brought us to kind of just a similar place of, we just want to know God. And as we start to wrap up this portion of the podcast, I would love to know, who are some of your favorite theologians, women specifically, but also I would love to hear any men, whose thoughts and words have inspired you on your journey, Caitlin?
That's a wonderful question. Yeah, a few that first come to mind. I'm first thinking of like contemporary people. I'm a really big fan of a dear friend of mine, Krista McCurland. She is a young theologian, teaches in New Zealand. Brilliant, wonderful. A couple others throughout history. I'm a huge fan of Mariah W. Stewart. Mariah is spelled like Maria, but it's pronounced Mariah. She was an abolitionist and a women's rights activist. The first woman, white or black, she was a black woman, but the first woman in American history to give a political speech to a promiscuous audience, promiscuous meaning men and women were both present. she's an incredible theologian, just amazing. Another really early church theologian that does not have her own writings, but is someone that would be kind of like an important person to remember in church history would actually be Augustine's mother, Monica. I'm a huge Augustine fan. I've read more Augustine than I've read pretty much anything else. But people often forget that when you read his confessions, his story of his life and conversion, from the very beginning, his mother is laboring through prayer over him and is kind of counseled by a pastor that, you know, no, God is answering your prayers, and gets to really see the experience, this real transformation of her son. So I like to give that example because while there are so many women theologians throughout history that are incredible, it's often true that there are women behind the scenes doing good theology by their lives. Like Monica's theology is incredible because she believed God was sovereign. She prayed as if she believed the theology that her son would eventually write was true. And I don't want to discount that work because throughout history, because of a variety of barriers to women's theological education, there aren't as many as we would like. There are tons that have been really underappreciated. But I also just want to say, we don't have to meet the standards that men historically have had to be good theologians. We don't have to have had all the education or teach in a prestigious school or have some of my favorite examples throughout history are women who had good theology with their lives. And I think Monica is a good example of that.
Incredible people. And I hope everyone goes and checks them out. I think that that's just, I always love hearing new names. I had not heard of this, so I always love hearing new names in theology. So thank you so much, Caitlin, for offering your insight into this area. This was such a wonderful letter to speak into, and thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you for letting me. This was like a beautiful letter to get to hear and respond to.
Well, it is time for the May We Suggest segment of the podcast, where we will suggest to you something that we have been reading or watching or eating or wearing that week that just made life all the more beautiful to live. Everything suggested will be linked in the description of this episode for you to check out, should there be a link for it. So, Caitlin, what is your suggestion?
Yeah, this is a fun question. And I was glad that something did immediately come to mind that has just made me really happy this last week. And it's a book that is not, I don't know if it's published yet, but it's coming out very soon, called Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times by Elizabeth Oldfield. It is a beautiful book. In fact, I hadn't thought about this, but it is a really perfect book to recommend in light of the conversation we just had, written by a woman, and also a good example of why theology is not this esoteric subject like you described, you know, sequestered in the walls of the academy. This is a book of someone writing about her conversion to Christianity, but also just about what that theology then means for very practical questions of her life. Like it's not a, you know, dense theology book. It's very accessible. In fact, some of the things that she says might scandalize some Christians with some of her language, but it's real. And it's her saying, here's how for example, the doctrine of sin has explained things about my life. And here's how knowing that and having a theology of sin and a theology of grace has shaped my parenting and my community life, and goes in and has a whole chapter on money and what scripture says about money, but in a very practical way of just like, this is a gift to humans, figuring out how to be humans when they are themselves broken and the world they live in is broken. And that is a gift to us. And I love the way it sort of reframes, again, this is an esoteric subject sequestered from real life. This is what theology has always been, is humans receiving the revelation of God in scripture and then saying, how shall I live now? And having lots of complicated questions about how you go about doing that. And especially, I think, this year, especially for Americans facing an election year, and for many of us living in turbulent times, as the subtitle says, it is not just a good theology, it's a good set of ideas and practices for asking, how do I live well with the challenges that I'm facing?
Yeah, wonderful suggestion. Kind of similar to what I'm about to say. So I have recently gotten into the new habit of listening to audiobooks while I wash dishes and do various other household tasks that I just feel like I'm wasting time when I'm doing, even though I have to do them. Mm-hmm. So, but I've been listening to kind of more, not dense isn't the right word, but it's just books that I've been that have felt a little bit daunting to me. On different theological topics and philosophy concepts and things like that. And so I just have such a deep desire to continue learning, but I've also found myself kind of overwhelmed at the thought of sitting down and opening some of these books sometimes. So, and it's also just what I realized recently is the way that I actually retain information is hearing it. So I have found that when I am doing random tasks, I have just been turning on these audiobooks, and it's actually really made such a difference in how often I'm thinking about these things and reflecting on them and what is actually going into my mind and staying there. And so that's my suggestion this week. Whatever book has felt maybe too daunting to you, or maybe you just don't have the time to sit down and read a book all the time, and anything that you haven't picked up, but you've been wanting to try downloading the audiobook version of it while you're doing the laundry or the dishes or whatever else is on your to-do list. Maybe some of the things that you can try to dive into would be Revelations of Divine Love by Julian of Norwich. You could try The Interior Castle by Saint Teresa of Avila. You could try The Little Way of Saint Therese of Lisieux, just to name a few women in church history that have made such an impact on my faith, on many other women's faiths that I know. So so that is my suggestion this week. Try daunting audiobooks. So to wrap up this episode, Caitlin, how can listeners find and connect with you and see what you've been up to?
Yeah. I mean, for the time being, I am on Instagram and Twitter or X or whatever it's called. No promises about how long I will remain on the social medias. But you can also go to caitlinchess.com and find lots of things. But one thing that is close to my heart is a set of practices and prayers for an election season. I wrote them for 2020, but I think they're still pretty applicable for 2024. So if you are dreading that, whether it's this year or other years, those are all things that I have found to be really helpful. And some prayers I've written and some prayers I've collected that I think are good prayers to help give us a new sense of what we're doing and what matters and how to bring to God the very legitimate concerns and fears we have, but also then to find real hope in bringing them and peace in bringing them to God.
Wonderful. Well, if you want to get in contact with me, you can search my name on any of the socials and reach out. And of course, check out Wallflower Journal for articles about relationships, beauty, recipes, personal stories, and so much more. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to Dear Wallflower today. If you have a question you would like answered, you can send your letter to dearwallflower@wallflowerjournal.com. Every letter read will be kept totally anonymous. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.